Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with comedian, actor, and writer Gerard Carmichael. Gerard Carmichael is like no other comedian I've ever met. First, he had to be persuaded to even consider stand-up in the first place. Then, he leaves North Carolina for Los Angeles without ever having gotten up on a stage. Shortly thereafter, he winds up with an HBO comedy special directed by Spike Lee and his own show on NBC. And he's still in his 20s. How did he do it? Well, if you've seen his act or watched his sitcom, you know it wasn't by making people comfortable. He's funny, yeah, but he's out to provoke thought before laughs. And he takes some unexpected positions on our hottest issues, minus the obvious punchlines and rhetorical bluster. Hear how he came by his incredible confidence and unique voice, and why The Carmichael Show has quite a bit in common with All in the Family. I admit that Gerard's work sometimes makes me squirm a bit, but in person, I felt like I was in the presence of an honest, unfiltered original voice, and that's what we look for in our comedians, our philosophers, and our thinkers. Gerard is all three. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Gerard.
Hi, Sam.
I am intrigued by what you do.
And oh, thank you.
I love your comedy, although I don't know if I'd totally call it comedy. I wonder if there's a word that means the combination of like refreshing and disturbing.
Oh, wow.
That's what you sort of represent to me.
Both on your show. I appreciate that.
Both on your TV show. It's called The Carmichael Show on NBC.
NBC.
And also on your HBO stand-up specials. And what I also find interesting is that there's not a ton of clips of you on YouTube, which is kind of great, because I think that sometimes when a comedian gets chopped up into so many little clips, like that works for some people, but it seems like for your style, there's a flow and a rhythm to what you do that you wouldn't want to break it up into bits.
That's true. I mean, like, you know, anything I talk about on stage reflects how I feel in my, you know, mental or emotional state at that time, you know. And so even topics that are unrelated are all through that lens. You know, it's all through the lens of right now. So even if you only show one bit, I think it's all... You know, it's meant to be cohesive, you know, emotionally. And so I don't like to release a lot of things that, you know, just for the sake of having content out there. I think it's better to just have stuff that you're excited about out.
Yeah. Also, I think that, you know, for people who haven't seen your stand-up, it is unique and different in the approach. And I want to get into all that. But I want to start with your show, because I read something that struck me as... Your television show is probably the only network sitcom that has a professor of sociology and African American studies hired on staff as a consultant for when like the more controversial issues come up.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you about that, because if you look at the subject matter and the titles of each episode of your show, it reads like a dossier on the issues that are being faced in our nation today. You know what I mean? I mean, you got protest, kale, transgender equality, abortion, gentrification.
It's a lot. Yeah, wow.
Prison, depression.
You know, happy sitcom stuff.
Porn. And Trump.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so explain this to me, because in your stand-up routine, one of your sort of platitudes is that you just can't care. You try to care, but you just can't care.
Yeah.
And then I look at the topics you hit on your show week after week, and I go, okay, well, something doesn't equal out here.
Yeah. Well, it's this emotional battle with indifference, you know, or being apathetic in the wrong times, and the struggle with that. I'm just someone conscious enough to know that. Certain feelings aren't the right ones and don't contribute in a meaningful way. And it is a challenge with that. It's like, I really want, you know, the things that we say that aren't even like the points that people laugh at are as important. Just the, like, I don't like that I feel this way. You know, I actively don't like, but just that struggle, capturing that battle is what's fun, I think. The show, a lot of times, is an argument. with stand-up, it's this once how I feel at this moment is just whatever truth I can express. The show allows me to frame it in an argument, and I can hear the other side, and I can hear the rebuttal. And so, you know, even through an emotional battle with indifference and through things that you try and wrap your head around and things that you want to feel something for and things that just collide with your life in such a degree that it's unavoidable, I think that's what the show is. You know, it's all of that in one place, and the stand-up is just, you know, one man's perspective.
That brings up a question of your persona when you do stand-up versus your persona on the show. Who is more like you?
There are moments on the show that that overlaps, but for the most part, stand-up is just kind of such a pure expression. And even if using devices like satire or whatever, it still comes from such a pure, honest place, and it's unfiltered. It's just you, you know, like it's just you alone out there, and you've written it, and you are directing it, and you are performing it, and it's just you, and it's about connection, and it's just you and whoever you're looking at the moment, or you know, a group of people in the audience that may even disagree with you, but they feel something, you know, like that I like for what I create to force a certain amount of consciousness, like, you know, be aware of what I'm saying, feel what I'm saying.
Right.
And stand-up is just the best outlet for that. It's so pure and fun, and I love that. You know, it's a place that brings me a lot of joy and comfort. So that's probably the most me that I, you know, I don't know in any other art form that I could match that level of purity. You
right,
know, you
right.
try with the show and you try, but for me, you know, what stand-up comedy at its best is just this exploration of a personality, is an exploration of a character or feeling or an emotion. And it's not all about laughs. I look at even the special as more of a documentary than, you know, just the special. I think it's a beautiful documentary. Hopefully people respond well to it. But it's just an exploration of character.
Right. I think the word comedy sort of undersells what it is you're doing. And I think there's a lot to talk about with that I want to get to, because you said documentary, and I think that, like, your work crosses over into, I don't know, almost commentary.
Oh.
you know what I mean? And I think your comedy's forcing the listener to get in someone else's shoes and to get another bias on what you're talking about. And I think that's a hard skill.
Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah, that's the point to me. You know, like when I think about even comedy, I just think, you know, I think about guys that I regard as philosophers, you know, even more than, you know, or people that do have that skill, that ability to, you know, evoke empathy from the audience, you know, and so it's through that connection. I think that comedy at its best does the same that music or a great film or paintings, like any form of art, is just the articulation of an emotion that people connect to. And comedy at its best does that.
Yeah, for sure. So let's back up a little bit. You know, I did some reading about you and you grew up very poor and picked on. And I wondered if, when you were young, if learning to be funny was as much of a coping mechanism or a survival mechanism as it was something you did for joy.
Yeah, you learn to be analytical. You know, you learn to kind of figure things out. And humor, you know, I think humor requires a lot of, like, information.
Like understanding your environment and where people stand.
Exactly. And you grow up in certain environments that force you to be very aware of things, you know, and so to kind of constantly take in information and humor is just the, you know, how that comes out. You know, it comes out just through that. Yeah, you learn to use it to your advantage, you know, in school, in the neighborhood, you know, you learn to, like any skill, you know, like you learn to, how can I use this to, you know, to protect myself?
When did you notice that, like, oh, I can do this and I can turn a phrase or make people laugh at something that they didn't see before?
Eighth grade was really big.
Oh, yeah?
It was an important time for me, you know, just having this teacher that, you know, encouraged me to read a lot independently and to question everything, gather information. I remember one time he started doing these class debates, and there was this article I don't remember exactly what was in the article, but it was about a man that committed a crime, but he had like a somewhat righteous cause for doing it. I remember those details.
Okay.
But he was dividing up the class and like who agreed with this guy and thought that he was justified in doing it and who disagreed. And I remember he said, who think he wasn't justified in the entire class except me, raised their hand.
Really?
And then they were like, well, who agrees with the guy? And I raised my hand. And then we argued for like 25 minutes. I remember it being the most fun time I'd ever had in class, ever had in school. It meant the most to me, and I just remember holding my own against, you know, like 20 other students.
That sounds strangely akin to stand-up because it's one guy with a whole sort of audience that you have to sort of win over.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that one experience, that single experience, informed so much of, like, you know, my life or humor more than any individual experience I can think of.
It must have also been notable that you were the only person that took an opposing viewpoint.
Yeah, and it was natural. And that's kind of a rule for stand-up for me, too, is that never be contrarian for the sake of, you know, like,
right.
Always have a truthful intention behind what you say, because that's what people will connect with, you know, and that's what will give license to, you know, I think people's attention. People will actually give you their time if they know that it's coming from an honest place and that it's really a thought or a emotion that you want to work out. You know, I think that people respond to that.
So around that time, I'm curious about if you started sort of dissecting comedy or if you studied it.
Yeah, I have this habit of with anything, like anything, trying to analyze it, it's hard to watch a movie with me.
Oh, really?
Because it's like I want to like I pause every like minute and a half and just like I'm really interested in it. And so stand up, it's no different. Especially by the time I got into it, I think I did it before even getting into it. I just like always had an interest in what it was.
Who would you listen to that struck you as smart and?
I mean. My mom and dad would listen to a lot of Cosby and Pryor, so I listened to a lot of them. But it kind of came from just kind of everywhere. The guys in the neighborhood are really funny. These really strong personalities.
Right.
You know, I remember growing up and just a lot of my friends had a really defined sense of humor, like a really unique to them, not just like kids will be kids, and maybe just by being in that world, maybe that's just how I looked at it, but they really had, like, my friend Philip was completely different than Alex and as far as what would make him laugh and what a joke of his would be like. And
so they had a voice.
They had a voice. Yeah. They really had a voice. I'm not even sure if they were aware of it, but they were, like, you know, more defined than even a lot of comics. You know, like, they
really?
Just had a really specific voice. And so, like, you always kind of tried to define your sense of humor, even within my neighborhood. Like, you always, you know, wanted your thing.
So what I hear you saying is that, like, you just had to fight to be the best among your neighborhood. It wasn't like they were all doing one thing and you were clearly the guy sticking out that was going to go off and do stand-up.
Yeah. No. We were all just funny. We made each other laugh really hard, you know, like, it just constant. And I'm sure all group of friends hopefully are like that, where they just can't. We were, but really, and we did it in ways too that were, I think, creative. You know, did all types of like shows for the, you know, we would do shows for the girls in the neighborhood, or we would do, we liked filming things and recording things and films.
Oh, really?
And yeah. We did a lot of those things just around the neighborhood. It was fun. It was really a show.
Do you remember the first time you found out that stand-up was an actual career that people could go and do?
I rebelled against it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I had my friend Ashley. She was really instrumental in getting me to actually try it, because I thought it was silly, like, you know, you're going to go up and just, you know, what's going to make a room full of people laugh. And like, a lot of it, how stand-up is marketed. There's so many amazing stand-up comics, but it's marketed so much like in this style of a court jester. And
right.
I rebelled against it because I know that's not what I wanted to, how I want it to be perceived.
What was your picture of how you wanted to be perceived back then before when you were rebelling against it?
Oh, man. I mean, outside of even Pryor, you think about like Mark Twain and you think about humorists and you think about these guys that really had something to say and a way to say it. And
like a satirist
voice.
Or somebody.
Yeah, a satirist or just these guys. You know, I believe that no matter what you, and this isn't even talking about style. If you found a way to juggle on stage and you're just the funniest guy doing it, I'm talking about perception. You know, and a lot of it is through the intention of the artist, but like the perception of comedy a lot of times is so dismissive and, you know, and I just never see it like that. You know, I see it as like just this, I'd see comics as being like a lot of times the smartest guys in the room.
And also I would assume that for a lot of people, comedy is actually a stepping stone to something else, and there's maybe more of a mercurial, a business aspect to just going and paying your dues.
It's abused in that way a lot of times.
Right. So what did you think you would be doing for a career? Did you think about that? Like,
I wasn't sure. You go through a lost period, you know, like any kid, I guess. There are actually some that were really certain, but only because I rebelled against doing stand-up and doing, I knew, like, I wasn't going to go to college. I knew I wasn't going to.
How'd you know that?
Because there was nothing that stood out to me that I wanted to invest 4 years of time into just studying to then do, just investing that much time into something. Like, I didn't want to just choose something. I would have just chosen a career, chosen a major, and I didn't want to just, I mean, that's your life, you know?
Well, like, it's funny, a lot of kids do just that, though. They feel like they have to go to college, and they may not know. And before they know it, they're in law school, and they didn't ever want to be a lawyer.
And they didn't want to do it, And it's like, you know, obviously, like, I think education is crazy valuable. That's the weirdest, like, sentence. That's the funniest, the more you know. Like, I think it's crazy valuable. Education.
Especially grammar.
Education's mad important. It's just the worst sentence to say. But it's obviously valuable, and it contributes to so many people's life, right? And some people do go to college lost, and they figure it out while they're there. But I knew I wasn't going to be one of those people that just kind of was lost on a campus for 4 years.
Right, right.
You know, and so I didn't. I knew that wasn't it. I didn't know what was, but I knew that wasn't it for me.
So if you rebelled against stand-up, what finally shifted or what made you eventually go and try it?
Two things. One, accepting that it is something you can do and that you have a skill or an ability to do, right? Accept it. And it also being willing to explore the curiosity, explore your own curiosity and just, all right, I'm going to do it, take whatever leap necessary to actually do it. And then I had the friend who encouraged me to do it refused to speak to me until I got on stage.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she was like, I'm not going to talk to you until
really?
You. Yeah.
Was any part of it fear of, oh, I'll go do it and I will fail?
Maybe in there somewhere. That wasn't the dominating thing. It was just, it really was making the decision to put that much time in. Because if you're going to do it, you really want to do it. That's why I started in Los Angeles.
Oh, so the person that was saying that to you, that wasn't at home?
That was back home. But I'm saying my decision to get on stage was my decision to move to L.A.
Did you do any stand-up at home before you left?
No.
So you never
got up locally?
No, that's
what I'm
saying.
Yeah, I never
Amazing.
Got up locally. I just moved. Because, again, that's what kind of the hesitation was knowing. I mean, if I was going to do it, I'm the type of person who would. I just wanted to fully immerse myself.
God, it's so funny to hear you say that. As someone who didn't want to go to college without knowing exactly what they wanted to do, you picked up your whole life and moved for something you hadn't tried.
Yeah. Yeah, I just felt, after accepting that, like, okay, she was really nice about, like, why I should do it. She was, I remember her telling me, like, I was like, yeah, it doesn't, just because I say funny things doesn't mean I'm a comic, you know. And she was like, no, but it's different. She just kept insisting it was different and that I should explore it, and I did.
Do you remember your first attempt at like a 10-minute set or a?
Yeah, well, the comedy stuff, 10 minutes, I mean, that doesn't even come for a while usually.
So what's the normal
like
set?
2 or 3 minutes at these
really?
And you're trying to define a personality within those 2 minutes, you know, and I remember I'm just kind of writing out sets just and complete, like just writing It's funny because I stopped writing as much, but I initially would write every word.
Like a script.
But I would do it like really fast while waiting to go up. I would write out the entire thing, and then I would memorize it. And sometimes I would have my notebook, but I would, for the most part, memorize it and just do it on stage.
Take me back to the feeling of the first time you're about to go on stage. Like, do you remember your opening line?
Potluck at the Comedy Store during the summer, and the list came out, and I was going up first. There's no audience, only comics in the back. I did a joke about calling, it was a really bad joke, about calling customer service for like Verizon, asking if cell phones cause cancer.
That's not bad.
I talked way too fast.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I talked way too fast, and then it was over. 3 minutes over, and then one of my best friends, Jamar, was like, "Yeah, man, you're good. Just slow down a little bit."
That was all on the first night.
Yeah, it was the first night.
You got that, because one of the things that's very distinctive about your stand-up is that you do allow for these long pauses, and you seem very conversational, and it doesn't feel rehearsed. It doesn't feel like there's any pressure to get a laugh.
Yeah, I like to take my time. I care more about the thought than the laugh.
Isn't that interesting? I think in earlier generations of comedy, there'd be all these guys on these circuits. I mean, the Catskills comes to mind, right? But this idea that anyone could get a bunch of jokes, whether they wrote them or not.
Yeah.
And the tradition was you tell a bunch of funny jokes and you're a comedian. And then comedy got more personal and comedy got more introspective and all kinds of things that required for a comedian to really get through. Mm-hmm. They had to have a voice that was uniquely theirs. And I doubt anyone writes jokes for other people now.
It still happens. And some people are really good at delivering other people's, you know, if someone writes for them, some people, you know, really lean so heavy into performance that they do. But you're right, the shift was to personality, you know, and perspective. Perspective is king. It's everything. And that shift, post-Catskills, there was a time when people were just, it was just like a community pot of material, you know.
Right, and you could hear the same joke by four different comedians.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's funny, even though the times don't seem to reflect it, it was still about personality, because your favorite version of that joke is going to come from your favorite person. Yeah, their delivery and everything's going to change. And so comedy only got better once, you know, that personality started having perspective.
And people found out that was okay and it worked. And it's an evolution, right?
Yeah, and it's still dangerous. You know what I mean? Like, it's still,
How do you mean?
I think it's still, what's fun is that it's still like an art form that it's, again, it's just you, your words, your thoughts, your perspective bare, just out there. You know, and there's a certain amount of danger to that, you know, because, you know, audiences can disagree, you know, like they can disagree, they can do, you know, that's why I think that it's such a pure art form, because the risk is so high when you're out there.
Well, I have so many questions about that, because I don't think that anyone can come out fully formed, knowing their voice, understanding how to put it all together and have the wherewithal and the self-awareness to understand how the perspective works with the material, how the material works with the audience, and how the rhythm works with all of those things. Mm-hmm. But do you recall a time like when a light switched on and you're like, oh, I know who I am?
Yeah, it's always kind of happening. It's an evolution. Like any, like growth of any sort, it's just like this over time, because between that first set and my second, I feel like I understood it so much more. The growth is so, I mean, it's like a person, you know, the growth is even more rapid in the beginning,
right,
you know, and you just figuring it out. And by just Jamar saying, slow down a little bit, you know, it helped inform a lot of you know, my delivery and a lot of, like, it helped inform because it made me go even more honest. And really, a lot of times with comedy, it's just someone getting deeper and deeper and getting, going further into their own minds and their own emotional
right.
state. You know, it takes a lot of reflection.
Okay, so you said a little earlier, you're more interested in about the thought than the joke.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the process of that, of having a thought and doing the hard work to where it can end up in your act as a fully formed idea that becomes a joke, that becomes something that people can relate to that they never thought they had a thought about before.
Oh, wow, that's a great question. I think that it's, you have to understand it first, you know, so, you know, you spend time trying to understand how you feel and why, you know, and then just on stage, seeing if I can get others to understand it. You know, it's the same as any conversation. It's just, all right, well, trying to find myself at a place where I can completely articulate how I'm feeling and why, and see if I can make you understand it in, you know, in the most rhythmically fun format. You know.
So give me an example. You're driving down the street and you become aware that you have an opinion or a thought about something.
Yeah.
Does it go through a test in your head like, oh, that could work? I mean, give me an example about how one of those ideas, those germs start.
For example, it's just like, you know, you driving down the street and have the realization that like, oh, I don't need my father's approval. I don't care about my father's approval. Now you're just off analyzing your childhood and figuring out, like, like, how did you come to this conclusion? And then whatever punchline or whatever comes from that, it just kind of comes from exploring that thought. But if it's an honest feeling and you want to explore it, you know, and your natural way of doing things is releasing tension through humor, then we'll find something funny. But I just want to find how I feel and why I feel that way.
Right there is the mystery to me about comedy, because we can all have the thought that we don't need our father's approval.
Yeah.
But the genius of comedy, I think, is finding connections between things that other people don't really think exist, or they wouldn't have thought of them. And you can connect two unrelated things and make people feel a third thing.
You know, look, you have certain thoughts or lines or things that you know as a comic, you're like, yeah, no, this works. You know conceptually that it works, but a lot of times you just kind of have to put it up on his feet, and just the only way is to see the interaction. Because you'd be surprised. If it comes from a place of truth, people really connect with what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and it's like, if I'm really exposing myself emotionally and saying like these things that I feel vulnerable saying, you know, it's coming from such an honest place that, I guess what I'm saying is that it really exposes how much truth transcends everything, you know?
Right.
And if you are just honest in your material, in your thoughts, that people, it finds a way, it really does click.
And it crosses racial barriers, and it makes it so.
It crosses everything, yeah.
There's nothing you can't say.
Yeah, there's nothing, you know, the truth is so important, you know, and so I just try and stick with that.
You know, watching you on stage, I get the sense that, whether involuntarily or not, there's a little bit of a Socratic method to your comedy. And it seems like often you want to take a pretty extreme opposing viewpoint as a way to find out, almost like what you're saying when you were in class, right?
Challenging and
Yeah, but the idea that by taking an opposing viewpoint, you're going to find out more about the viewpoint that everyone else is opposed to.
And if you're curious about any subject, if you just follow your curiosity, you know, whatever subject you're talking about, like if you follow your curiosity through, a lot of times it is these contradicting emotions and
right.
thoughts and things that just kind of come out and you challenge. Socrates is just amazing at through questioning, you know, always through questioning, you know, and that is the, you know, exploring your curiosity, just constantly questioning from all angles.
Right. Well, a good example of your humor is you make this statement, talent outweighs morals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you start out with an example of Bill Cosby or something like that. And it's sort of like, well, let me say the most extreme version of this. And then the entire audience can feel that sort of squeamy feeling of, I'm not with him on that.
Yeah.
And then you ask them all if they still listen to Michael Jackson. And you make a pretty good argument that our society has a pretty good history of letting people with talent off the hook for some of their questionable moral behavior.
Yeah.
And you sort of call people out for that. And you start with an audience at a place where they're about to walk out on you. Not maybe not literally, but in their mind, you start out at an extreme place.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you if that's sort of the art of it for you. Like, is the art to see how far you can push an audience away and still pull them back in?
There are certain moments where it is fun to you know, go to certain extremes. It really is like, it's like fire. It just makes everything, like, you have to be aware of what's being said now.
Starting with that.
Starting with that, it's just like, we're awake. You
right.
know what I mean? Everyone's
right.
awake and listening because you kind of have to.
But I think that what you do so brilliantly is you can do this push and pull with the audience where you can get them off your side and get them back on your side. And it seems like it happens too often for you not to be aware of it.
Yeah, yeah. It is fun. It's fun. It's just it's like a fun method, you know, just like a method of arguing, you know.
Yeah. Well, have you ever had a situation where you kind of lost the audience and you couldn't get them back?
Most nights, man. We got no. I have no. You want to think that you can get them back. You want to hope that you can get them back, you know. But then certain times, it's never intentionally. It's always with the purpose of exploring. So, like, if you lose them sometimes. And then, look, sometimes you and the audience just don't connect also. You know, you just don't connect. And I always take the blame for it. I never want to blame a room. I like to think that you can. Try, I mean, even if it's a naive thought, I want to believe that you can make any room understand you, where you're coming from, and be able to laugh. And sometimes it just happens. You lose it. But I mean, on the best nights, it's for the sake of exploring. You know, on the best nights, it's like, I really need to explore this thought, and it may go to a dark place, and I may not be able to relieve the tension in this moment, you know, but it's for the sake of figuring it out, you know, in a real way.
In other words, I hear you saying it's more important to be honest to the material and to yourself, and the audience, it's going to work or it's not, and sometimes you're not going to connect.
But again, the challenge and the goal is for it to connect, you know, like the intention is for it to connect.
Sure.
You really want to, you know, and you'll have nights, you know, everyone, you know, has nights. Anyone who's trying something new and trying, like, you could do your tried and true whatever, but a lot of the fun for me is just finding something new. So, you know, you'll have nights where you just, you know, you just miss.
Right.
You know?
Do you learn more from those nights than from the nights where things go
straight? Oh, yeah, those are important nights. Those are really important nights.
Like, is there an example of where maybe it went horribly and you walked away with a specific piece of knowledge that you can recall?
I mean, a lot of new thought. There are some that just immediately I know exactly. Oh, I know exactly what this is. But any new thought you're working out, you know, especially, you know, a lot of the premises and things that I'll say is, it's really challenging. So, like, a lot of times, anything new that doesn't reach the right punch or the right relief is, it can get a little uncomfortable for some people, you know, because it's just like a raw.
Well, that's the thing.
Feeling.
I think that when it's not feeling like comedy, it's still feeling like an exposure of a human. And
yeah.
You say it's going to go dark, and you say that.
Yeah, yeah. my attempt at a disclaimer.
Yeah, but I think that is the bravery of comedy, is that the great ones, the ones that are making art out of it, they are willing to sacrifice themselves in sake of trying to get someplace new.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, the only thing that matters is that you're growing and you're trying and you're taking these swings. And there are growing pains and there, you know, there are consequences to growth.
It's funny with an audience, too, because I feel like when I watch you, sometimes I notice you're kind of zeroing in on one person.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't even know what the method or why I do that exactly. Because sometimes I'll kind of just start speaking to the person that's connecting to it the most. And a lot of times I'm speaking to someone who I think is connecting to it the least.
Oh,
which
really?
Is always my favorite. And it's never caught. I'm not that type of person. I'm not that type of person that, you know, I'm never like picking on anyone. Or it really is just a conversation. I don't come in and, someone walking to a room, I'm not the guy that's like, look at that shirt. You know, I'm not that type of person. So
right.
It's always with the intention of like, no, I want you to understand where I'm coming from. You know, like, help me articulate it. You know, like, in a sense, like, what do you, and so I'm talking to them, even if it's, you know, not an exchange, it is a conversation.
So you're almost reading their facial expressions.
Yeah, you read it. You read it. I want to see it. I want to see what you think. You know, I'm aware when people are really listening. I'm aware when people are shutting down. I don't want anyone to shut down. I just want to explore the thought. It's not the intention of, I don't want to make anybody angry, but I do want people to feel something. And if anger is the how you feel or frustration or you completely disagree, that's okay. You know, my job is to really explore the thought.
Do you consider your audience in terms of the racial makeup for the material on that night? Like, if you come into a room and it's primarily black or primarily white, will it influence your material?
No, not at all, because it's like a lot of times, and I've seen it where people will talk down to black audiences, even black comics sometimes like speak in a way that like is almost talking down. I think black audiences are like some of the smartest, like the most in tune rhythmically with what I'm saying, and emotionally with what I'm saying. I never want to give either audience a lesser or a dishonest show. You know what I mean? Because it's dishonest. If you to adjust and change, it's like, and now I'm being dishonest, and it's important. It's important to me that, especially like young black guys connect with it, but just being who I am and where I'm from, it's important to me that they understand what I'm saying and like understand where I'm coming from. So I owe them the most honest show that I could give. And I owe, if it isn't a white audience, the most honest show that I could give. You know, like it's so important to be equally as honest across the board. If I switched up the act and it's like, oh, I'm gonna do this because I'm in front of white people, I'm gonna do this because I'm in front of black people, that's lying. You know, I can't do that.
Well, that makes total sense, because I think the experience I have with your comedy is that I am getting honesty from you and I'm getting authenticity. But at the same time, there are topics that you talk about that that a black audience is going to hear with a different bias than a white audience.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where it's my job to make the articulation as clear as possible. You know, and a lot of times, really the differences between us a lot of times are just reference points, just like references. Like, I think everyone connects with the same human emotion, and we all have the same wants and desires and fears and needs. And by the same, I mean, we all have them. And, it's really easy to connect with those things as long as I don't block it with certain references that may detract from the point.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like that, that's just being mindful in how you word it, but I try and do that so that it is the same for whatever ear hears it.
I think maybe that's something that I find I connect with you, is that I don't feel like, oh, I'm watching a black comedian talk to a black crowd about his experience that doesn't include me. I don't feel that with your stuff. I do feel uncomfortable at times about some of the things you're bringing up and even where you stand on it. I'm not sure if it, like where you are sometimes, and that's part of the art, I think.
Yeah, it's just like just the this raw uncomfortable thought of just saying it as a challenge and like saying these, and those are the thoughts that I think are most interesting. And that's what I try and bring to stand up, like the most interesting thoughts that I have, and there's a full person in there. And again, that's part of the expression is to show you more and more of the full person. I think the difference even between that first special and the second one is, it's even more about the person.
Well, yeah, from the opening shot when it's tied on your face and you're saying, are we going to be all right? You don't know what you're watching at the beginning. Is this a comedy special, or is this like, is this going to a place where we're going to see someone fall apart on stage? First minute, you're like, I don't know where this is going at all. And it is. It's very different than anything. I mean, you should be really proud of it.
Thank you.
It's very different.
Thank you for saying that.
Before we go to the show, I want to ask you what you're hardest on yourself about, like post-show or in any aspect of your life, where is the thing that you keep running up against the wall challenge-wise? When are you your toughest critic?
Oh, man. I'm wondering, do I ever leave the bubble of criticism? I don't know. It's always that I'm really controlling, and I care about productivity a lot. And so I care about everything that I do contributing to a meaningful way. So I sometimes have trouble letting go.
Oh, really?
And I have to be conscious about just being free and really experiencing. And don't get me wrong, I intensely feel a lot of emotion, like love and joy and happiness and appreciation. But it's still a difficult time. I have a difficult time letting go. So I'm the toughest on me in the sense that everything that I'm doing, I try and make sure it's contributing to my life and work and these things. So I don't know if that answers. I know that's a little off from it, but it makes me constantly in a state of thought that, can be really critical at times.
So the voice can be like, the voice, it's got to be better. I think that's probably pretty common with a lot of people who do this kind of thing for a living. Because who's going to push you? Who knows enough about what you do to push you like you could push yourself?
Exactly. And that's a blessing in itself, though. Having that, I think it is a blessing because it's like, what else are you going to do? what else are you
going to do? Is that how it feels? Didn't do this?
Yeah, not push yourself, not trying, not put a lot of thought into it. Like, what else are you going to do? I want to work as hard at my job as any hardworking person at any job. I hope doctors and lawyers and
you hope anyone, they're working that hard.
I hope that they're constantly. I hope if you're a heart surgeon that you're constantly just in your head about, man, I gotta do these heart surgeries better.
I gotta get it right.
I could be stronger on valves. Arteries are kind of a weakness.
Yeah, I gotta lower my instances of leaving sponges in the human body cavity.
You gotta lower that. Yeah, just like I hope that you're constantly.
Yeah,
constantly
maybe the people that are really critical on themselves should be the doctors and not the comedians.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm really hoping that.
No one's going to die if your show goes
just so
bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Doctors. Yeah. Get your shit together, doctors.
Exactly. Well, okay, so what I find fascinating is I read that you turned down a perfectly good acting part on New Girl. Before you had any inkling that you would eventually have your own show on NBC. Is that accurate?
I had the hope. I had a lot of faith and hope that I was going to have the show. But it just wasn't right for me. I had a vision for what I wanted a show to be. And so anything else just didn't feel right.
That speaks so much to the confidence of believing in what you do that I would say 95% of the people in that position would say, well, bird in the hand, I'm going to go be on this show for a while, figure out how to be on a show, and still work on my dream of having my own show.
Yeah.
Are you someone that had a bigger plan the whole time?
Yeah, I always wanted a show on NBC. I always wanted a special on HBO.
Really?
Yeah.
You can die. You're done.
Yeah, that was, those were really important things to me. And now the fun is just trying to do it again and trying to find growth in it. But like those were always goals. And, so I just focused on that. Anything else just wasn't for me, I don't think.
Well, what fascinates me about your show, first off, it's so autobiographical in terms. I found out that the names of your parents on the show are the names of your parents in real life.
Yeah. And I don't go too far.
Right. But, what struck me about your show is that it is, in terms of its setup, it's conventional almost going all the way back to the original sitcoms in terms of it's a play that's filmed like mm-hmm. All in the Family. Some ways, I see a lot of parallels between All in the Family, even with the architecture of the living room.
Yeah.
With the stairway that goes up.
Yeah. And Norman set such a great groundwork for, what shows could be, this groundwork for arguments and conversations in a really serious adult tone.
Well, you look at what the character of Archie Bunker was, and he was someone who he employed a little Socratic method himself for coming out on a really bigoted platform and then sort of creating an argument for his family that he was brought around sometimes, or the family was brought mm-hmm. around sometimes. I mean, there are parallels there.
Yeah, he was frustrating to, you know, those who opposed him, you know, and he was so bold and so strong and steadfast in his beliefs that it was frustrating, and it created so much hilarious conflict,
yeah.
but genuine conflict as well. You know, the most important thing, just such this a rich character who didn't care about, it wasn't about likability, it was about honesty.
No, and that's yeah. who he was. What's interesting, though, is I feel like you spread that guy around to different characters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
like all your characters, you on the show, you have a girlfriend, you have a brother, the brother's ex-wife, and your parents, and that's mm-hmm. and it's sort of the living room with that crowd. That's the show.
Mm-hmm.
But while still giving everyone their own characterizations and their own backstories, so they're never out of their lane to tell a joke, any of your characters.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you give them each things to be maybe either blind on or bigoted on or mm-hmm. really right on, and you spread that around, unlike the central figure of Archie Bunker being sort of the flashpoint.
Yeah, yeah, everyone is, try and write them as human as possible, you know, and just being human, you make mistakes and you have certain things that you aren't aware of and certain beliefs that are rooted in the wrong things, and it comes out in an argument, and it just spills out in a passionate moment of discussion.
Yeah.
And so we look for those things.
Did you find it was a hard transition to learn how to write for television and multiple characters after writing so long for yourself?
It was. I mean, it is just figuring out rhythm and figuring out, you know, just how to do it. But multiple, because you naturally kind of have, a lot of people do, just these thoughts that battle each other, you know, and we have these great battles in the writer's room, and like,
you
know, but even within me, it's just like always, like I feel this way, and I also feel the opposite. We did the special, and I kind of rebelled against having kids, and recently I had two nieces that were born. That's making me rethink the whole thing. Oh, it's a really scary thought, by the way, Sam. It's just the fear of like, going from this fear of having children to kind of really wanting one, you know what I mean? Like kind of really.
It's called growing up.
Julia. Yeah, but that's even within the past few months, you feel, you know,
yeah.
I've started to feel like a crack in the old dam.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, do I want children? Wow, that's a new thought and feeling. And so now on stage, you know, you watch the special, you were like, he was so against it.
Yeah.
And
that's the scary thing about putting down
recently.
Opinions, right?
Yeah, but no, that's the...
Humans change.
But the important thing about... But see, that's the thing. In comedy, it's supposed to show growth. Richard Pryor showed you growth. It was a guy who said nigga constantly, who on stage said, I'm not going to say the N-word anymore. He went to Africa and had a revelation, and I'm not going to say it anymore. And he showed you growth, you know.
Right.
And I mean, he said it, he named albums that, and that's a huge part of, you know, his personality, that he then changed his opinion on. He changed his views on. He grew before our very eyes. And
yeah.
comedy doesn't. I love Jay-Z in hip-hop. I think his music is amazing. Not just hip-hop, but in music, period, because artists don't typically grow. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if you're a young pop star and you sing, you know, these songs about, you know, relationships and one of these things, a lot of times you just keep doing that throughout your career.
Right, if you're lucky enough to keep...
You keep replicating it, and
yeah.
very seldom do you hear growth in music. I love Jay-Z because he grows, and he, you know, and I love Stevie Wonder because his opinion changes over albums, and where he was in Talking Book is, and also where he was in Songs of the Key of Life. And so... That in comedy, I think, should be the same thing. It shouldn't just be events that happen to you. I don't want to just record a special about, then I had kids, and this is about having kids. I want to do it, like, find myself at the emotion of where I want them and find myself find my where my emotion is around the whole thing, the entire process. You know, showing growth through that is so important, and like challenging and contradicting yourself and saying, well, I don't feel that way anymore, and here's why, and just going along a journey as opposed to just, and this happened.
What I hear you saying is that art stops being interesting when the artist is in it for to create a brand and keep that brand alive and have that same audience stay with the brand.
A lot of times even thinking branding, a lot of artists then try and fit into something that's already on the shelf, you know, as opposed to building the world around who you are as a human being.
Well, that's what I think is so interesting about what you're doing, is that you're willing to go up there and say something pretty crazy. Like global warming, what are we worried about anyway? We'll have our kids, grandkids. I don't care about the grandkids. Like, that's pretty out there.
Like, yeah.
That's short-sighted.
Very short-sighted. But I'm honest about how short-sighted I am. You see what I'm saying? It's, like, it's not even about being right or wrong. It's about me telling you, I even say within that like I'm aware that this is like, I'm sure it's a real issue. I know it's a real issue that's destroying the earth.
Yeah.
However, I don't feel as strongly about it as one may think I should.
It's and that's being very honest.
It's being very honest.
Yeah.
That's an honest thing. I it's not about like that thought itself, of course, is an unlikable thought.
Yeah.
It's a really unlikable thought. If you care passionately about global warming, but it's like, hey, hear me out. This is why I feel this way.
It's funny because what's happening right now is the exact feeling I feel when I watch your stand-up special, which is, I can't fault the guy for being honest. I know some of his opinions are because he's still in his 20s. And he's turned me around on a few things as well. So, I mean, that's really what you want out of an artist, right? You want someone who's willing to ask the questions, take chances, put themselves out there, and not be so cemented in that the next time out, you could have a completely different opinion.
Yeah.
Well, okay, I have to ask you before we finish up about the fact, okay, so you got picked up for 6 episodes, your first season.
First season, yeah.
I would think that there's pressure there because it's a new thing for you to be in a multicam sitcom. Like, that's a learning process, to mm-hmm. know how to be in front of 3 cameras at once and a live audience. And you've surrounded yourself with really experienced actors that have done this before.
Yeah.
And I would think that the bar would be set pretty high, that you only have 6 episodes to sort of get a second season. Like, you have to get good pretty quick. Did you feel pressure or anxiety about that, of having to sort of learn all those new skills all at once while you had this short time to prove yourself?
No, not really. It just seemed like a fun challenge. It seemed like a fun thing to figure out. And I was in such a habit of writing. I mean, Ari Kacher, who a best friend write things with, I mean, we wrote, this is going to sound like an exaggeration, but by the time we filmed the pilot, he and I alone have written probably 20 versions of a pilot together.
Really?
Like this, it sounds like we would just write things out, and a lot of times it would lead nowhere or whatever, but like
you just take an idea and just write it out.
And we've been writing, and we write so much that like I was already in the rhythm of like creating and just trying to turn over ideas and trying to develop it.
The show is called The Carmichael Show.
Yeah.
And it's sort of your dream, and you get your shot at it.
It is. I mean, it's like you better be good.
Do you think that doing stand-up for so long, you sort of, like, even though you didn't have specific experience of acting, you had so much experience being in front of an audience that...
Yeah. You become, in a good way, like, numb to the... It's no, like... You're so used to an audience. Like, by a stand-up comic, 5th year, if you do it consistently, I mean, you could probably wake up in front of an audience and just jump into an act.
Really?
Yeah, probably. You know, I think that's like a universal trait. If you're just every night in front of a room full of people, you just become... I mean, with that said, I know some guys that still get a little nervous no matter what, but for the most part, you're just so used to it.
Did you work really hard for a long time before anyone knew who you were?
Yeah. I mean, it's constantly just in a state of work.
Like, give me an example of when you were coming up and doing clubs, how many nights you would work?
Oh, every night. Every night. I go, and still to this day, I mean, if I'm doing stand-up, like, only because of the show, and recently, this is the longest I've ever gone without going up, just recently, like a month or two without performing, but other than that, every night.
Well, see, like, I hear
every
you saying
night,
that.
Multiple shows a night.
And it's like, okay, if you're used to working on an act and doing stand-up in front of a live audience 7 nights a week for so long, and then you take on this show, and you're writing it, you're producing it, you're starring in it, I would think that would present its own challenges of how does the material not get diluted, or how do you find time to have the life experience, to have the thought, to create the story.
I will say a lot of times I'm able to get a lot from a specific moment. I'm really thankful for that, like where, you know, experiencing a thing once or having one really specific experience can really, I'm able to like last, it's able to last for a while. You know,
you can really mine it for all of its
really
treasures.
Really, like there are certain things that, I mean, I've talked about things from different angles, like one night from different angles on stage, you know, just been able to kind of mine it. But life is always happening, even if you, it's just being honest with where you are in life. I don't need to just go skydiving tomorrow, right?
To have a new thing to talk about,
because even just if especially if you're looking at internally, like, you know, if I am just constantly working and I just work, then that's still a very relatable mindset. You know, like whether it's whatever I do or whatever your job is, if you have that mindset, then you understand it.
Right.
You know, like my aunt works at a plant and we were both getting in at like 4 a.m, right? Like just her after a shift and me just getting in when I would stay with her in New York. And we both just talked about working, like, oh yeah, and I would tell her, yeah, I did 5 spots tonight. She was like, yeah, we had this shipment come in and we would talk about it because it's just what we can relate. And even it's completely different experiences, there's something universal about the specificity of the emotion.
Do you think anyone outside of that small circle that sees you every day knows how hard you have worked to get here? Like, your friends from home, could they understand how hard it is? Or does it look like luck to a lot of people?
I'm sure. I mean, I don't, like, I'm not a person that carries a lot of stress. So,
I am
having fun. I have a lot of fun. You know, it's just that it's just constantly, I'm constantly working. And I love it. You know, with that said, I also love it. But, you know, the people closest to me know, you know, they know by the fact that I call them at 3 a.m. just to talk out ideas. They know that it's kind of just a constant state. It's my default state.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait till you have children and we see how that lifestyle fits into.
I'm gonna be such a bad dad. I'm gonna be a horrible father.
No, you won't be.
These are children's lives we're gambling with. Do we want to take a gamble with that?
Well, you know, you're in your 20s.
We'll figure it out, right? But now I want them. What am I gonna do?
Well, you have to have a girlfriend and a wife.
Yeah, I want children even more than marriage right now. I'm in this weird spot.
Well, that's okay. You could just maybe, you know,
Have in vitro
fertilization.
Have a Debbie Rowe situation.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know.
Listen, it's been really fascinating to talk to you. And I think as someone who's not a comedian, but I'm so curious about how it's done. You know, you kind of let me see into the process a little bit.
No, thank you for being really warm and easy to talk to.
Well,
I hope some of this is usable. Hope some of my rants.
we'll get 20 minutes out of it.
There's a solid 20 in this.
No, it's fascinating. So thanks for coming in and telling me all about it.
Thank you.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. Make sure you catch Gerard's comedy special on HBO entitled 8. It is an hour plus of the most original comedy you're going to find this year. And check out The Carmichael Show on NBC. You know, Gerard may not be on social media, but we are. So if you want to check us out, comment, like, tweet, retweet, post, you can go to Off Camera Show at Twitter, Sam Jones at Twitter, Off Camera Show at Instagram, or Sam Jones Pictures at Twitter. But most of all, you should go to the website, offcamera.com, and check out all of our past episodes, and also visit our store where you will find our unique, limited edition off-camera magazine. We make one for every guest, and it's a great way to support the show and make your coffee table happy. So check that out. And most of all, make sure to tune in next week when I sit down with actor Maggie Siff.
I just wanted to be a professional actor, but I had no aspirations for stardom. I could not imagine. There was a director I worked with in my early 20s who was like, you should go out to LA. And I was like, phew. I don't even know why. It just felt impossible.
By Hollywood standards, she came to TV late, but has quickly proven her serious acting chops on hit shows like Mad Men, Sons of Anarchy, and her current role as therapist Wendy Rhodes on Billions. She's a fascinating actor with a fascinating point of view about her own career, and you don't want to miss this conversation. Now, if only someone would just put her in a screwball comedy. See you next time, off camera.